Hello and welcome to USSOcast, a US Studies Online podcast. In this series, we chat to PhDs and ECRs about their research, their life in academia, and all things in between. Today, I'm joined by Mike Cowburn, a political science PhD at Freie Universität Berlin, whose research, among many other things, examines changes in the dynamics of congressional primary competitions in the 21st century. So firstly, Mike, welcome. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very well. Thank you very much for having me.
No, an absolute pleasure. How have you been getting on this term in particular? You've been pretty busy.
Here in Berlin, we've been in some form of lockdown since November. There's really not much else to do other than stay at your desk and get the work done. I suppose on the one hand, it's kind of an additional bunch of stress with the lockdown, but on the other hand, I guess further stressed by us having no excuse of why we haven't got things written and got things done, really.
On the topic of work, you want to tell us about your research and feel free to go into as much detail as you'd like.
Yeah, absolutely. So my research project looked at intra-party factionalism within the two major parties in the US. And I basically make the case that in the 21st century, and certainly by the second decade of the 21st century, we now are looking at two major parties which contain a bifactional structure. And what I do is I use the congressional nomination process, that is the process by which candidates are selected for congressional, for US congressional seats, and show that the nature of these competitions has fundamentally changed. So what do I mean by that? So my thesis documents and demonstrates that back in as recently as 2006, congressional primaries in both parties tended to take place for what we call in political science valence factors. So what we mean by that is things like competence at running or prior experience in other offices. And what I show is that over the past, six electoral cycles, first in the Republican Party with the influx of the Tea Party faction, and then more recently within the Democratic Party with kind of the Democratic Socialists and the progressive faction of the party, what we now see is that these competitions take place are much more policy-based. So we see competing policy agendas within each of these big tent parties. And we can also see when we turn to the political science literature, a similar pattern. So if you read about things like polarization and party identity in the early part of the 21st century, the common refrain is that as the parties have moved apart, they have become ideologically homogenous. So in the later decades of the 20th century, we saw a drastic decline in the number of conservative Democrats and the number of liberal Republicans. So what that meant was that the parties were much more ideologically homogenous. But in the past decade, we've seen a huge amount of work that's focused on how parties operate internally. And we've actually seen a new way of conceiving of parties. So that's commonly called the UCLA school. And if we think about works on the presidential nomination, like The Party Decides, we see that this new conception of parties is as networks of activists and office holders and of coalitions helps us better understand what's going on within the parties as well as between.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much. There's a lot to unpack here. I've got a few questions to kind of send at you. And obviously, this is a lot of this is over my head, I should say. I'm not a political scientist, so I have a lot of admiration for the work you do. With the way things have gone and the way obviously you're kind of looking to the future as well of your research, do you ever see like any kind of way back from this bipartisan system? Like as things have kind of got more polarized and it's now become, you know, two-party system almost, is there any way back for an American electoral system that regresses to a different system? Or is this kind of how it's going to be for the foreseeable, do you think? And it's only going to continue to get more entrenched?
So when we think about the American electoral system, particularly, obviously, we're coming at this from, both of us not studying within the US, gives us the ability, you know, gives us the frame of reference of a more multi-party background. And the US system simply doesn't allow it. I cannot foresee any future in which we don't have two major parties. There was the brief idea that was floated of Trump forming something like a Patriots Party. Mm-hmm. But I guess a lot of my work focuses on one of the reasons why we have these factions within the parties is that we're just conceiving of electoral competition in a completely different way. I go as far in my research, and certainly other other authors make this case as well, that these factions serve as miniature parties within parties. So Rachel Bloom, in her book last year, How the Tea Party Captured the GOP, has that nice phrase. And I think particularly coming from a European context, certainly from a continental European context where multi-party democracy is the norm, what we might want to do is actually think of these factions that operate within the parties as fulfilling a lot of the roles that Europeans understand parties as fulfilling. So then we've got it, but because of the nature of American electoral competition, there are only ever going to be two parties. You know, even when we go back in history, it takes one other party, it takes the Whigs or the Democratic Republicans falling away in order for a new party to come forward. In terms of the lean towards bipartisanship, I think that really does depend on the actions and activities of the Republican Party in the next 5 to 10 years. I think there's now a clear divide within the Republican Party, not just along an ideological level or a policy level, but on an adherence to democratic norms level. And I think if we look at both the priming that was done by former President Trump last year, and then the reaction both by him and by members of Congress following the electoral defeat in November, we really have to consider, this intra-party faction of the Republican Party that is no longer willing to accept democratic norms. And when we think about polarization, we need to think about that as being a central feature of it.
That's great. I mean, one thing I was thinking about, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the election a little bit later on. I've got a couple of questions there, because obviously that was, a watershed moment for a political science student looking at the American system. Obviously, there's a lot of talk, there always is, about the Electoral College. And obviously, I'm complete layman in these terms, so this might be a non-starter for you or a bit reductive. But how does the Electoral College as a system, obviously an antiquated one to a lot of people, how does that factor into what you look at? How does that engender polarization? How does it affect the way people are voting in kind of like congressional primaries that you look at? Does this have much of a sway or impact on your research? Or is it more just a system that's been there for hundreds of years, and you just have to kind of take it and run with it?
So there's a couple of different aspects to that question. So starting with the Electoral College and its connection to polarization, what the Electoral College does at a presidential level is it means that Republicans can, in the current electoral coalition, it means that the Republican Party can win with a minority of the vote. So as we saw in 2016, as we saw in 2000, the Republican Party now does not need to win the most votes in order to win the presidency. And what that has is it has profound effects on the type of policies it can pursue and the attempts it needs to make in terms of building a coalition able to win a national election. Conversely, of course, what it means is the Democratic Party need is to win the popular vote under the current setup by 3 or 4 points. And so that has quite important effects down the ballot. Obviously, the Electoral College doesn't play a direct role in congressional races, but what it does do is it helps shape how the parties conceive of themselves. And it helps, so what that means is the Republicans are freer to pursue a base strategy without, and knowing that if they can get their 42-43% of the base plus just a little bit more, then they'll be able to win the national elections. What I would say is that a similar pattern exists in Congress as well. So while the Electoral College favors the Republican Party slightly in the current setup, the way that the Senate elections work, with two senators being elected from each state, and given the heavy overrepresentation of rural states, which are overwhelmingly Republican, we see an even bigger impact there. And so I think, I've not got the exact figures off the top of my head, but basically the 50 representative, the 50 senators who are Democratic at the moment, represent far, far more Americans than the 50 senators who are Republicans. And even to a lesser extent, but also within the House of Representatives, the demographic distribution of voters gives Republicans a further advantage. So we know that Democratic voters tend to live in cities. That means they're much more clustered together. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, it means that they can be gerrymandered easier. So the Republican state legislators can construct seats that traps Democrats, that puts Democrats in. But also, even if it wasn't for gerrymandering, we see this even in states that don't have partisan control of districting, Democrats are at a disadvantage just because of the distribution of where their voters are.
In terms of like gerrymandering specifically, this is a term, obviously, I always hear in the news, I've looked it up, never fully got a grasp on it. And obviously this is, to you, this is the bread and butter of what you do. So for the listeners who might be, you know, listening, thinking, I hear that term a lot in electoral rhetoric and not fully certain how it operates, how would you kind of describe it in simple terms?
So let's use a real world example. Mm-hmm. So every 10 years in both the UK elections and in the American elections, we have a process of redistricting. So we have a census, and the constituency boundaries or the districts are adjusted to make them broadly representative, so that they broadly a constituency represents roughly the same amount of people. Mm-hmm. Wherever you are.
Yeah.
Now, in the UK system, that's done by an independent party, an independent body. So that body has no affiliation with, say, the Labour or the Conservative Party. And I think the British electorate would probably find that quite strange if it did.
Yeah. So the idea is it's impartial. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, in the United States, in a few states, they have a similar system. So, for example, in Michigan, they now have a similar system. But in many states, the people in charge of drawing those district boundaries are the state government. So it tends to be the state houses, but also the state governor. So control of state legislatures becomes really important in years ending in a zero, like the one we just had, because yeah. The years ending in the zero are when the census goes out. And so the midterm elections that are fought next year will have slightly different state boundaries than the ones that were for the House of Representatives than the one that was contested previously. And at the moment, Republicans have more control at the state level. So it means that they're able to, and they did in 2010 as well. And so it means that they're able to draw districts which favor them. Now we need to just think through a little bit what that means. And what it generally means is it means packing all the Democratic voters, which, as I say, is easier when they all live close together anyway, yeah. And packing them into super safe Democratic districts, and then spreading other districts between Republicans, meaning that they get more people sent to Congress. We've seen in the last few years a couple of examples where drawing of boundaries has been ruled unconstitutional. So for example, in Pennsylvania, they had to redraw all of the districts midway through for a term. But broadly speaking, that's what the practice is. Just for some historical context, it's important to say that whilst Republicans have been more guilty than Democrats of this in the last 20 years or so, and going way back, there is a long history of this, and both sides have a long history of doing it.
Yeah, I can imagine there's guilt on both sides there, historically. So is that like protected constitutionally or what? Because obviously it's controversial, people want it changed. And you say some states have the system that we would have where it's impartial, kind of works impartially. Obviously there are people fighting for change here. Where does the change occur? A kind of state level, federal level? How is this kind of protected? Is it state by state?
Yeah, so the important thing to think about when we're thinking about US elections, and again, from a European purview, this feels slightly strange to us. Even in a federal country like Germany, elections are administered by the states mm-hmm. to the point that your ballot will look very different depending on what state you're in. The whole ballot design and the whole administration of elections is taking place at the state level. And so one of the things that the Democratic Party is trying to do at the moment with what's called HR1, the For the People Bill, is to establish more federal standards for how elections are run. And the Republican counter argument to that is that that's overreach by the federal government. Their argument is we have a federal system. This is a power that is in the hands of the states, and that it's overreach by Washington to try and formalize electoral standards.
I can't even imagine like how complicated it must be for you and the political science cohort, just dealing with, you have the three branches of the government, you have state by state legislation that it differs across the geography of the country. And I feel like there's just so many moving parts to the US political system to keep track of. And I mean, I guess one question very simple is, how do you just keep on top of a system that just seems like it's constantly changing all the time, but maybe isn't at all? Maybe the fact is it's not changing. That's the issue with stuff like the Electoral College. And then a slightly broader question as well is, how do you find dealing with actual quantitative data? In, I'm obviously from an American Cities Lit background. It's all qualitative. I don't work with any data at all, really. And obviously that's the bread and butter of what you do. So what's it like, having that kind of just rigid set of numbers to work with, as opposed to, I don't know what the alternative would be, but yeah, how is it for you working with data like that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I do also do some qualitative research as well. And mm-hmm. this is a hotly debated topic within the field of political science, and you'll get people on both sides making very, very valid arguments and broadly concluding we need both qualitative and quantitative research. They, of course, bring different things to the party. In terms of the undertaking of quantitative research, I use a lot more maths than I ever thought I would be doing.
I couldn't do what you do.
I finished maths GCSE, 15 or so years ago now, and thought that was me done with it, and boy was I wrong. I think there's an interesting disciplinary angle to this as well. So, for example, my undergraduate degree was in the UK, mm-hmm. And that's an undergraduate degree in politics. I'm now doing a PhD, and as I would be if I was doing it in the United States as well, in political science. And there's a slight but very important difference in those terminologies there. And those differences, I guess, are broadened by the place where you do your research, and really kind of how much work you're going to do on the quantitative side, how much engagement with kind of economists and modeling you do really depends on the institute at which you study. And so I've been very lucky in that. So I'm in the Department of North American Studies, but we have a very broad interpretation of what of North American Studies and what that means. So we not only do we include political science in that, but we also include economics in that, which I think, which certainly if you compare that to a lot of American Studies departments, they have a narrower interpretation of American Studies, and certainly they would do if you were in the United States.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear how you're balancing qualitative and quantitative research in that way, for sure, as someone who obviously is just very much rigidly one way on the spectrum. Speaking of that, I mean, you've recently co-authored an article with Michael T. Oswald, I believe, on ideological differences and cleavages within the Republican Party. Do you maybe just want to tell us a little bit about that and kind of background into what led to the publication of that paper?
Yeah, absolutely. So this was our paper for the Midwest Political Science Association last year. Mm-hmm. So Michael Oswald's background is looking at media and fake news. Obviously my background is looking at these intra-party divisions. And in many ways we've got more attention from it following the January the 6th insurrections, and kind of the narrative of intra-party division within the Republican Party is now kind of, you can't go a week without looking at a New York Times article on the subject. But what we show is, so what we do is we profile Republicans in the House of Representatives who'd served at any point since Donald Trump's election. So that's the, these data are 115th and 116th Congresses. And we use quantitative scaling measures So these are things like DW nominate scores, which are based on how these representatives are voting in Congress to place them on an ideological spectrum. And we show that these measures are highly correlated with their use of what's termed the fake news label on platforms like Twitter. And so what do we, it's important to just clarify what I mean by the fake news label. Essentially, when we're talking about fake news, there are two types of fake news. There is real fake news and fake news. And so real fake news is new information that is untrue, and that is known as the fake news genre. And then the fake news label is this manufacturing of, or this claim of fakeness in order to delegitimize established media sources. So that's specifically what we're looking at in this paper. And we show that highly conservative members of the House of Representatives were much more likely to use language which demeans these established media sources with accusations of fakeness. And this has a kind of long history going right back into, you know, the mid 20th century of conservative media spheres accusing the established media of liberal bias. And we make the claim that this is an evolution of that term from bias to outright fakeness.
That's really interesting. So you obviously look at the role of Twitter as well. And I had a brief look at the article. I haven't read the whole thing, I should say. You kind of talk about like Trump's claim to have coined the term and things like that. I mean, it's really interesting thinking about kind of authenticity of coinages of terminology and things like that, when in many ways what Trump is doing there is itself fake news. It's kind of, there's an irony there. So how is the dynamic of social media kind of engendering these things you're looking at, and maybe, you know, furthering other aspects of your research as well, just the way people are interacting in a way they never previously have with elected and unelected officials?
So yeah, I think we have to be careful. I think on the one hand, there's definitely the potential for this two-way engagement, which is something that's new, and it is something that potentially allows for these feedback loops, which drive, which may move the positions of elected officials. On the other hand, a lot of what's going on has been going on for a long time, and I think that we have a tendency, particularly when we don't understand, if it's something that we don't understand. And I think what's happened with media fragmentation over the last decade and a half leads us to often say, this is a new paradigm and everything's completely changed. And when you look back at a lot of kind of classic political texts about public spheres, what you see is kind of a lot of parallels with what's happening today. I think that the kind of the bottom-up polarization piece is certainly interesting. But actually, I think quite a lot of what's happening is top down, is that these elites hold extreme positions and they are filtering these down through whatever channels possible. Mm-hmm. But I do concede that certainly these channels are maybe enabling figures who would alternatively struggle to find platforms into that. I'm just not fully convinced that social media is to blame for elite polarization, because I think that this is a top-down phenomenon more than a bottom-up phenomenon.
It's more complex than that, for sure. We've kind of touched on this a little bit. I want to just talk to you more generally just about what your life's been like in the pandemic and stuff in a little bit, just after this question. What was the election like for you as an individual and as a political science member of a cohort where you are now and as a political scientist? You'll remember I can't remember what day into the very long drawn out election it was, but I messaged you just saying, you know, which way is it going to go? Give me some, you know, give me some good news here, Mike. Yeah. And, you know, obviously I have only recently really figured out how it works with the Electoral College from watching, you know, the endless loops of CNN on my computer while I was working. So just, you, did you have a lot of people coming to you for advice? Did you feel a lot of responsibility knowing what your research is on to have the right answers for people? And obviously, what are the right answers? And what do you tell people who, like me, just don't understand what was going on? What was that like as an experience for you?
Yeah, so I guess there's a few different threads there. So let's start with the election. So this election, I mean, from where we're sat now, looking back on the election results, when you look at that election, it's a reasonably decisive win. Mm-hmm. Fine. If there have been certain votes in certain states that have gone the other way, not that many. But from an electoral college standpoint, it's a relatively clean-cut win. As, by the way, from an electoral college standpoint, Trump's was in 2016. Mm-hmm. What was strange, or not strange, but what required explanation about the 2020 election was that we had these delays in votes being counted. So we knew that some states looked wrong as the votes were coming in. So a good example of this would be Ohio on election night, because Ohio had counted all of its mail-in votes early. And so what that meant was it looked like it was going to be really competitive and potentially even a Biden win, because of course the way that the two parties had primed the issue of absentee ballots meant that those ballots were overwhelmingly Democratic. And so Ohio is a really good case in point, because there are a lot of people on election night thinking that Ohio was going to be in play. But of course, if you knew the makeup of the votes that had been counted and the votes that had not been counted, you could see that was going to trend Republican as the people who voted on voting day came in. Of course, in the important states of Pennsylvania and Georgia, we have the exact opposite. So in Pennsylvania, for example, none of the absentee ballots could be counted prior to election day. So when the first lot of results came in, they're the in-person voting. And so it looks like a safe, it looks like it's going to be a safe Republican seat. And it's worth noting that Republican, again, state government, state politics here really matters, because Republicans in Pennsylvania made the decision not to do what Ohio had done in order for them to potentially construct this narrative of the election being stolen. Mm-hmm. So in previous election years, we'd just have had the results and we'd go, okay, that state's blue, that state's red, we know what's happening. Whereas there's this extra uncertainty coupled with just a horrendous result for Democrats on the night in Miami-Dade County, which just scared everyone so much, and meant that Florida went red. So that's the election night. But I do also think you're getting at something kind of more generally here. Yeah. So what you find as someone doing a political science PhD is you become everyone's kind of political therapist. So every time anyone has questions about any kind of politics aspect, you're their go-to person, and that's very comforting, and that's very nice in the sense that people are interested in what you're doing. The downside of it is when you get everyone on Twitter who thinks they know a lot more about political science than you do, or politics than you do. I imagine that people doing PhDs in physics get that a bit less than people doing that in political science. But I do think as a political scientist, one of the roles of political science has to be to communicate with the public. And whether that's in WhatsApp chats with friends or writing public facing pieces, I do think that there is value in the knowledge of political science. And I do think that value has to break out of the academic discipline, and that has to involve public engagement.
Yeah, I think there's great value in what you do. And I think it's very generous of you in the way you've described to, you know, whether it is personal or front-facing, public-facing, to share what you know. Because, you know, as a lit student, you know, you're never going to be called upon to answer the great problems of our time. So it's not a feeling I can relate to, but I admire it greatly. And, you know, thank you for humouring me during the election when I messaged you with my qualms. I'm going to end how I kind of end every episode of this podcast that we do, which is just for you to reflect on how the pandemic's affected, you know, your research in any way you wanted to talk about, really. But has it affected visiting archives for you? I mean, of course, did you have things planned? Obviously, it will have affected them, I'm sure, if you did have some plan. How's your cohort interaction and that general, you know, sociability changed? Do you have digital seminars and things like that? And yeah, how has your general process changed or not changed, as it might have been, over the last 12 months?
Yeah, so, I mean, the good thing from my point of view for the PhD project is that the thesis as it stands can be written now from my desk in Berlin. So that's a fan, which is definitely not the case for a lot of people writing PhD projects in political science. And so I've been very lucky, more through luck than judgment, that my proposal for a project could be done distantly. Yeah. Having said that, the extent to which you feel that distance is certainly increased. I had plans to be in America last year and present at conferences, and also then obviously do things like networking and you know, integrate yourself into an academic network. There aren't that many people within Europe writing about US congressional primaries. It's a relatively niche US domestic politics topic. So the fact that you can only engage with people over Zoom calls, over Twitter, really does exacerbate that sense of distance. And I mean, one of my advisors is Sean Theriault in Texas. And so, I mean, we haven't seen each other face-to-face for, going on nearly 2 years now. And so plans like that, plans to go and stay in Texas for a bit and work directly with other professors working on this topic or on ideas close to this topic have been, that's been really tough. And in terms of how the university experience or the PhD experience has been, again, similar kind of ideas or feelings of distance and isolation, I think, which are I imagine are common and not, you know, discipline specific. Our classes since the summer semester, so for the last year, of course, they've all been online. So a lot of that has meant that, you know, building your own support networks and this kind of thing has been really, really important. And yeah, you definitely feel like you're missing out on a lot and missing out on the exchange of ideas, which is really hard. And you know, you try and replace that through digital media, but it's difficult as well.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts there and for coming on today. It's been really, really great to speak to you and for joining us. I should say, if anyone out there listening wants to come on to the podcast themselves, they can get in touch at usso@bass.ac.uk. That's BAAS. And we'd very much like to have you on. But yeah, Mike, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.